What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I speak with Julia Boyd. Julia Boyd is the author of the Sunday Times bestseller and winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for History, Travelers in the Third Reich. Her previous books include A Dance with the Dragon, The Vanished World of Peking's Foreign Colony, The Excellent Dr. Blackwell, The Life of the First Woman Physician, and Hannah Rydell, an English woman in Japan. She's written a new book, which we sort of circle our conversation around, called A Village in the Third Reich, How Ordinary Lives Were Transformed by the Rise of Fascism. Hidden deep in the Bavarian mountains lies the picturesque village of Oberstdorf, a place where for hundreds of years people lived simple lives while history was made elsewhere. Yet even this remote, idyllic village could not escape the brutal iron grip of the Nazi regime. A Village in the Third Reich crafts an intimate portrait of German life under Nazi rule. It is upon that central thesis that Julia and I have our discussion. And now I give you Julia Boyd.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Julia Boyd. Julia, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. I want to discuss your new book, A Village in the Third Reich, How Ordinary Lives Were Transformed by the Rise of Fascism. I also want to discuss some of your other works as well, and perhaps maybe broadening it slightly to the craft of writing as a whole, which I'm very passionate about myself. Before we do, Julia, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Right. Well, I live in London now, but I've spent a lot of my time living abroad. My husband, John, was a diplomat, so we lived in various countries, quite a lot in Asia. Then after he left the Foreign Service, we went to Cambridge for 10 years, which was great fun. He was Master of Churchill College, and we had a lot of American students there, which was a great bonus. And for the last 16 or so years, I've been living in London and trying to write books. So that's about it, really.
Oh, wonderful. Perfect. Thank you, Julia. So I'd love to know, perhaps dialing the clock back a little bit, Julia, when was it that you decided to become a writer?
Well, I never did decide to become a writer. When we were living in Japan, I was asked if I'd write a book about a rather unpromising subject, a missionary who built a leper hospital in the early part of the 20th century. And some Japanese people were very keen that I write this book. And I said, well, it might be rather hard to get a publisher. But anyway, they were so enthusiastic that I wrote a book about this woman who, in the end, turned out to be very interesting. And what I really enjoyed was the process of finding unpublished documents and then weaving the story of this woman into the bigger picture of Europeans in Japan, which was a fascinating story. And then when we went to Cambridge, I thought, oh, well, all these libraries around, that was good fun. I'd like to try it again. But I hadn't a clue what to write about. And then I hit upon this woman called Elizabeth Blackwell, who was advertised as the first woman doctor. But I'd never heard of her. And I thought, what an extraordinary thing. First woman doctor. And I'd never even heard of her. So I wrote a book about her. And that was interesting. The same thing. The bigger picture in that case was America. And she was English born, but the family went to America. And it was really about women's rights. It was about women getting into medicine, the state of medicine, all these things. And it was a very interesting family. She had very interesting siblings. She knew Florence Nightingale very well. So that are, and there were a lot of wonderful unpublished documents, a lot in the Library of Congress and at Harvard. So I had great fun doing that. And then I thought, well, that's it. By this time, I was hooked on writing. And so I wrote a book about foreigners living in Peking in the first half of the 20th century. And then it was suggested to me that I write about foreigners traveling in Nazi Germany. And that's why I landed up writing about the Third Reich.
Wonderful. I appreciate you tracking through that, Julia. Were there any particular writers or works that you would say influenced you?
Oh, that's a good question. I've always enjoyed, and I say this with great sense of shame, I never read enough fiction, really. I'm always drawn to history, writing, and science. And one book that does stand out in my mind that left a deep impression on me was the memoirs of Madame de La Tour du Pin, who wrote about, I mean, she lived in an astonishing time in France, court of Louis XVI, right through to sort of post-Napoleon, she was in exile in America. And the way she wrote was so vivid that you absolutely felt transported to the time. So I suppose perhaps subconsciously that left a mark on me. I mean, what I'm trying to do, I suppose, with my writing is to try and give readers a sense of what it was like to be there at the time. And of course, if you use contemporary documents and letters and unpublished memoirs and diaries, people who were writing not for posterity, but just recording their circumstances as they saw it, you do get this very sort of fresh feel to history, I think, anyway.
Yeah, indeed. I appreciate it. That's very interesting. So I'd love to know then, what was it that drove you to write Travelers in the Third Reich?
Again, I always need to write books that are other people's ideas. It wasn't my idea, but it was suggested that this might be a good subject to write about. And I first thought it was complete nonsense because, after all, the Third Reich is probably the subject that's been written about most in my lifetime, more than any other, and also by all these brilliant historians. So really, the idea that I would have anything to add to it never occurred to me. But I was curious, so I started digging around, and then I found an astonishing amount of what I really call raw, unfiltered history, history that hasn't been edited, hasn't been thought about at a later date, right there on the page, written there and then. And there were so many diaries and letters lurking in archives and attics that I began to get a real sense of the period in a different kind of way. So I was hooked, and that turned into Travelers in the Third Reich. And I thought that was it. I was all finished with the Nazis. And then I met this extremely nice woman who comes from Oberstdorf, and she asked me if I'd write a book about her village. She had, in fact, already written a book in German, but she wanted something that then the village were keen that a new book be produced that would sort of reach a wider public and perhaps people who'd never even heard of Oberstdorf. So that's where I came in.
Very interesting. I'm grateful to you for bringing up the idea of historians. That allows me rather smooth transition to my next question. Yes, and you're quite right. I mean, World War II it has had some amazing historians. I think of Martin Gilbert, Ian Kershaw, Donald Cameron Watt, AJP Taylor. I could go on.
Richard Evans.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. So I'd love to maybe broaden it slightly and just kind of get your thoughts. What role do you see for historians in shaping public discourse and understanding of the past?
Well, I think something quite interesting is going on at the moment. Again, in reference to the Second World War, you know, ever since the war, there have been so many volumes written about the major players, the generals, the politicians, concentrating on that end of the spectrum, if you like. Whereas I think now there's been quite a discernible shift away from the most famous figures and the big battles and the strategy and so on to perhaps focus more on, I rather dislike the phrase ordinary people, but I haven't come up with anything better, but on the people, you know, the likes of you and me who might have found themselves caught up in this and how they reacted and how their opinions and views evolved over time. Because I don't know about you, but I think there's been a tendency to, I was born just after the war, now 74, and I certainly grew up in a world where we looked at this whole period very much in terms of black or white, Nazis, monsters, anyone who wasn't a Nazi was a hero. So, but as we all know, life simply isn't like that. You know, I don't know about you, but I certainly live in the grey most of the time. And I think that there is certainly now a more perhaps nuanced look at this whole terrible period in history. And So, I mean, looking at, for instance, going back to Oberstdorf, the village that I wrote about, you know, people changed their minds. Many people started off very enthusiastic about Hitler because they felt after the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles, which shot Germans everywhere, that here was a politician who at last was going to put Germany back at the top table of nations, who would restore the country's prestige and prosperity. And so a lot of people started out, I think, enthusiastic supporters of Hitler, but then were horrified once he was in power. Contrary to what people had mostly thought, that things would sort of simmer down and the worst aspects of anti-Semitism and so on would subside. On the contrary, they only got worse. So a lot of people did, I think, change their minds. And perhaps that hasn't been accentuated enough in the books that we all read. And the diversity of response to the Nazis in towns and villages, as opposed to a sort of national response, I think, is now being looked at more closely. And one other thing I would say, which has struck me and has relevance to what's going on with the Ukraine today, is when I was writing Travellers in the Third Reich, I spent a lot of time reading letters written by the Quakers, who were extraordinary. They were in Germany in January 1919, just 2 months after the armistice, and they were immediately traveling around the country preaching their message of peace and reconciliation. And they wrote reports back to the Friends Library, meeting house here in London, and their letters are in the library there. And they were traveling on trains talking to people, and they recorded these conversations. And the thing that struck them over and over again, and you must remember that many Germans were starving at this time. They were terrified of the communists. There was insurrection in many cities. And of course, they were mired in grief with the loss of their loved ones. But the Quakers made the point that the thing that seemed to pain them most was the humiliation they felt had been visited on their country. The Treaty of Versailles came as a terrible shock to them. And to be treated, for their country to be treated as a pariah, and of course, they were stripped of their colonies and so on, at a time when countries, you know, their prestige was judged by their empires, which is, of course, difficult to imagine now. But so humiliation was something that really, really mattered to them. And I think, well, I've certainly seen it cited as one of the reasons for the current war in Ukraine, that Putin was felt so deeply the humiliation and anger at the dissolution of the Soviet empire. So maybe that is something that, although people are facing terrible difficulties, that maybe their country's humiliation is something that has been underestimated as a driver of conflict.
Yeah, indeed. That's very interesting. Yeah, and never forget that about Hitler, that at the time, that there was a time when he was extremely popular. I think Time magazine appointed him their man of the year, if I don't miss my mark.
Yes, it's a famous photograph.
To their everlasting shame. One quick comment I have. You'll undoubtedly be familiar with the Mitford sisters.
Yes, of course.
Yes. One of my favorite stories is Jessica Mitford had the opportunity, because of her relationship with Unity and Diana, her sisters who were friends of Hitler, had the opportunity to actually shoot Hitler, to assassinate him, and could have saved all of us such trouble, right? But I thought about the fact that that would have occurred in the late 30s. And if that had happened, she would now be remembered as a terrorist.
Yes. Yes. That's a very interesting thought, isn't it? But a lot of people claimed to have nearly shot Hitler. And there was somebody I came across the other day who nearly knocked him down in his motor car. So, but I wouldn't exist if Hitler had been killed. We wouldn't be having this conversation because the world would have been so different. But yes, it's very tempting to say if only and what if. But unfortunately, Hitler became a very much a reality.
Yes, yes, without question. I think you may have gleaned at an answer here, Julia, but I think I'll ask it full-throatedly and just let me know if there's anything else to add. What was it that did inspire you to write A Village in the Third Reich?
Well, in the course of writing Travellers in the Third Reich, I met Kati Patel, whose family come from the village and been there five generations. And so she asked me if I would write this book. And what I think was the incentive of her and her fellow villagers, a group of villagers came together in the early part of this century and decided they really must record the village's Nazi history before all those who had actually lived through it had, you know, died. And so Kati wrote this book, which is full of interesting and fascinating information. But I think from my point of view, the most interesting thing were the interviews she conducted with the villagers who had lived there right the way through the Third Reich. And of course, by the time I came on the scene, they were nearly all dead. So without those interviews, I wouldn't have been able to give such a clear picture of the varied response within the village to Hitler. I mean, you had at one end of the spectrum, you had people absolutely opposed to him, hated him. There were socialists in the village. And then you had people who, as I say, were enthusiastic and then changed their mind. At the other end, you had the absolutely devoted Nazis who stayed loyal to Hitler right through to the bitter end and beyond. But the people that, in a sense, interest me most are the ones that changed their minds. And there was a fascinating example in the village, none other than the village's own mayor, Ludwig Fink, who, you know, he even had a little Hitler moustache, and there are photographs of him making robust National Socialist speeches in the marketplace of the village. But he clearly changed his mind when he saw the true nature of the regime. And, you know, you might ask, well, why didn't he protest? Why didn't he resign? Why didn't others who, when they realized they'd made an error of judgment supporting Hitler, why didn't they do something about it? And I think the honest truth is that when, after the March the 5th election in 1933, the once really in power, Hitler imposed the totalitarian state so fast and so completely that if you, as mayor of Oberstdorf, which was, you know, quite a senior position, you started saying, well, actually, I don't like what you're doing, the chances are you would have ended up in Dachau or perhaps even guillotine. Now, even if you were brave enough to accept that fate, what about your family? And they would be left destitute. So a lot of people, I think, had no choice really, but to kind of try to fudge it, to look as if they were complying, but actually doing their best to keep their distance. And Ludwig Fink helped. There were only a handful of Jews living in this village, but he helped protect them. He looked after other villagers who got on the wrong side of the Nazi law. He helped the nuns when they were targeted by the Nazis. And right at the end of the war, when he was under very, very strict orders to shoot or execute anybody who tried to surrender, he absolutely ignored that. So my own sense of think was that he was fundamentally a decent human being who had supported Hitler for possibly understandable reasons. That's debatable. But in any case, he did his best to mitigate the worst aspects of the regime. And I think there were probably hundreds of thousands of people like him throughout Germany.
Yeah, no doubt. It's one of those things that, you know, you and I sitting here safely removed from World War II and the Holocaust, of course, it's a pleasant thought to think back that, well, if I was alive during that time period, of course I would have hid Anne Frank in the attic. You know, I would have sheltered someone beneath the floorboards, for instance. It's a very pleasing thing to think about, right? But you just can't quite know.
I don't. You know, I've thought about this, as you can imagine. I've now written two books about this period, so I have endlessly thought about this. And I've come to two conclusions. One is that, yes, I would have absolutely loathed and hated the Nazis. I'm completely sure of that. But I'm also certain of something else, which is rather more difficult to digest. And that is that I know I'm a coward. And I think if I'd especially, but probably not even without children, I would have just done my best to survive. But if I'd had children, I would have done anything. I would have hired Hitler to get a bit of extra milk for my children or somehow to make life a bit easier. I'm sure I would not have been brave. I say that with no pride at all, but I think with self-knowledge. And I think the question that we all have to ask ourselves, and I'm absolutely not trying to whitewash the Nazis. I mean, there were Nazis in the village who were really absolutely committed. But I do want to emphasize really that this thing of putting yourself in the position, the question I think we all have to ask ourselves is, what would I have done? So I think that, you know, that is a very important factor when you're once thinking about this whole question of guilt. But I've been trying to perhaps highlight the villagers who were not committed Nazis, but I think it's worth mentioning one man who lived in the village called Heinz Schubert. Now, he was in this particularly horrible unit, the Einsatzgruppe, who went in after the Wehrmacht into a newly conquered territory to murder Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, anybody else that the Nazis didn't like. And he was tried with other people in the Einsatzgruppe at Nuremberg. And he, first of all, claimed to be descended from the composer's family. And that really does make you deeply, deep intake of breath when you think that somebody, Franz Schubert's family, could have descendants. Well, Schubert didn't have any children, but it must have been one of his siblings. It's sort of a mind-boggling thought. But at his trial, he said to the prosecutor, "We thought we were saving Western civilization." And I think such was the brainwashing of young people, through the Hitler Youth, and it was endless. And you must remember that there was very little information coming in from outside. There was no internet. So the propaganda endlessly was telling young people that they were surrounded by enemies, that it was their duty to fight for the fatherland. So a lot of young people, they weren't just beating up Jews and smashing windows and behaving like thugs and louts. There were young people who felt a genuine loyalty to their country. And after the horrors of the First World War and all the humiliation and starvation and everything, they wanted to go there and do good things for their country. And I think that's also quite hard for us to realize. It was closer to the war, it became more difficult to believe that. But in the early 30s, being a member of the Hitler Youth or the Bund Deutscher Mädel, the girls' version, was really not so dissimilar to being in the Girl Guides or the Boy Scouts. I mean, I'm not sure what the equivalent is in the States, but, you know, those youth groups that were always doing good things and helping old people and that sort of thing.
Yes, Boy Scouts will do. I've actually thought the same thing. I saw a movie called The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes.
Yeah, and, you know, the family, there's the, I don't know what you'd call it exactly, the propaganda tutor that comes in the house and teaches, and there's posters of Hitler and so forth. And it does sort of solidify in one's mind just what the groundswell of propaganda and brainwashing looked like. In case you're at all curious, I've also given the thought, you know, what would I have done?
What would you have done, Joshua?
Well, as it happens, I have an easy out here because with the last name Cohen, I would have been one of the people in the attic. I'd love to talk a bit about the research for the book. You kind of already gleaned at it a little bit earlier. I love talking about this regarding biographies and history. What was, obviously, I know with your co-author, there were those discussions and interviews that were had. What was your research process like for the book?
Well, it's interesting. You were asking me about my other books earlier, and they look very eclectic bunch of books, you know, First Woman Doctor, Foreigners in Peking, and then the Nazis and a Japanese missionary in Japan. You know, that's a pretty odd collection. But what I would say is it's not so much the subject for me. It's really the approach. What I like doing, and sometimes I think of myself more as a weaver than a writer, what I like to do is to take quite a big slab of history and then go after the personal stories, the individual stories. I mean, I particularly like looking at unpublished material because very often in letters and unpublished diaries, people are just writing what they really think. In the published version, they've had time to think about it, to edit it, to look at it with hindsight. What I'm always keen to do is to get the impression there and then. And there is a mass of material out there. Now that we've all stopped writing letters, history is going to look very different in the future. But for this, I mean, I saw in a review somewhere quite recently, I was described as a micro historian, which was new to me. But in a way, it's quite an accurate description because I think, and I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think that you can often get a better understanding of the bigger picture by looking at it through an individual's experience. And if you get enough of these and you sort of manage to kind of group them together and you begin to get a kind of picture seen through the spectacles, not of the great leaders and so on, but of, use another hackneyed phrase, the man in the street or woman in the street. And so that's what I like to do. So really, my writing is more about a sort of approach. And people often ask me how I find the stuff. And there again, I don't know. It's a very difficult question, I find, to answer. I sometimes feel like, you know, those water diviners who have forked stick and the stick starts sort of jumping around when they find water. Well, I go after very slight leads. I follow things up. And of course, these days you can, I used to have to go to archives, but you can now look at findings lists and where you find a name of somebody you think, gosh, that would be interesting. And then you Google them and find that their papers are in North Dakota or something. And then you get in touch with the archives. And but often I've had some most astonishing bits of luck just talking to people, you know, in the queue in the supermarket or waiting for an aeroplane. And, you know, they suddenly tell you, oh, well, yes, their Uncle Joe was riding around Nazi Germany in his motorbike in 1936. So it's a curious process, but it's very exciting. And I spent a lot of my time in archives, wading my way through cardboard boxes of letters and papers. But I'm a bit of an addict. It's where I get my kicks from.
That's very cool. That's extremely interesting. And yeah, you're quite right about the, you just never know who might know who. I interviewed someone a while back, a CIA officer, who I asked him to get me in touch with someone he might know that I could interview. And it was he got me in touch with a Vietnam War veteran whose father served in World War II and was best friends with Patton. So all of a sudden, I had access to this wellspring of phenomenal Patton stories that no one's ever heard before.
Wait, this is, you absolutely hit it on the head, Josh. And I have a not quite so dramatic story, but when I was writing Travelers, I was very keen to find the papers of this New Zealander who became a very successful broadcaster and journalist after the war, because he was, as a young man in Germany in the 1930s, but I couldn't find his papers anywhere. And I sort of rather given up or put it on the back burner. And then I was in a bookshop in Zedbergh, which is a very small town in Yorkshire, on a very wet November day. And I was talking to the owner of the shop, and I'd only been working on this project a few weeks. And I said to her, have you got any books about Germany in the 30s? And she said, no, she didn't think so. But yeah, it was odd I should ask that, because her father had been in Germany in the 30s. So I said, oh, what's his name? And it was this New Zealander. And she and her sister gave me access to all his papers and his letters to his mother. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. And you can't quite believe it when it happens, but it's very exciting when it does.
Yeah, indeed. It almost feels like you won't be believed if you tell people.
No, exactly. But the Patton one, that's a really major one. That's must have been totally thrilling.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I felt like I struck historical gold there.
I think we're both saying there's a lot of luck in this game. And, you know, and what I like to do, if I possibly can, is I try not to just use one source. I mean, it's rather like, you know, when one broken a bone, you have an x-ray, they take pictures from different angles and to get the true picture. And I try to do the same thing. I try to get different accounts from different people to try and build up a picture.
Yeah, it's like that old thing of, you know, you have someone at one end of an elephant and another at the other end of the elephant, yes. Describe the elephant and you get two different pictures, but they're both true.
Well, exactly, exactly.
Let me see. I'd love for you to talk a bit about the, what shall we call it? Perhaps let's use the phrase social history, if I may, of how Nazi ideology gradually took hold in the village.
Well, that's also very interesting. I think one point to make is right at the beginning is that while people, and certainly this was true of Oberstdorf, voted for Hitler, and for many people, Hitler could do no wrong. When something terrible happened, they were told Hitler can't have known about that. But people may have been very devoted to Hitler. They weren't necessarily devoted to stormtroopers or the Gestapo or even the people around Hitler, the Goerings and the Goebbelses and so on. And this was certainly true of Oberstdorf, the village that I was working on and looking at so closely. Now, they made this village, was a very poor rural community, very tough life until tourism came along at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. And that really changed things for them. And many of the visitors that came to Oberstdorf, both in the summer for winter sports and in the winter, for winter sports and summer, to just walking and climbing and so on, many of them were Jewish from Munich and various other cities for all over Germany. So there was never extreme anti-Semitism in Oberstdorf, not necessarily because they were feeling particularly friendly towards the Jews, but, you know, they were hard-headed and they liked Jewish tourists because Jewish tourists brought their money. So there wasn't a great deal of anti-Semitism in the village, and they didn't like the stormtroopers and the noisy Nazi torchlight parades because they put off the tourists too, and they were just sort of loud, and they didn't like that. So you get a more nuanced picture of reaction to the Nazis. They were much pickier than you might think. They didn't like everything, but on the whole, they thought Hitler was terrific, and that if anything went wrong, it wasn't Hitler's fault, it was always somebody else's fault. The big question, the big burning question is how much did the villagers know of all that was going on? Because, I mean, when it was first suggested to me that I write this book, again, I wasn't terribly keen to begin with, for several reasons. First of all, I thought it was rather arrogant to think that as a sort of random Brit, I could just turn up and start saying, I'm going to write a book about your village at the most difficult and sensitive time of its whole history. But also, I felt, what on earth can this village have to say that's interesting or new about the Third Reich. I mean, it's right down in the bottom of Germany. It's the most southern village in Germany. It's quite remote. It's 100 miles from the nearest city, which is Munich. But I was completely wrong about that because, in fact, to my astonishment, I very quickly found that there really wasn't any aspect of the Third Reich or the Second World War that didn't affect the villagers in one way or another. So when we ask how much did they know, well, I think they knew an awful lot. For a start, one of the boys in the village was gassed in the so-called euthanasia program simply because he was blind. Then there were soldiers coming home on leave all the time and who had certainly either committed atrocities themselves or certainly witnessed them. And, you know, it's hard to believe they didn't talk about it to their families and friends. And then this was a real surprise to me. We've all heard of Dachau, which was 100 miles away from Oberstdorf. What I didn't realize that these big concentration camps spawned lots of mini camps. Round Oberstdorf, there were two or three sub-Dachau camps. There was a Waffen-SS training camp. There were slave labor camps. So there were all these camps all around Oberstdorf, and they saw the prisoners being marched to and from and so on. They knew about them, and they knew about the appalling conditions they lived in. And then just 10 miles north of Oberstdorf was Zonthofen, where one of these Nazi castles was built, and Himmler came there to brief local Nazis about the final solution. And then Messerschmitt and BMW, they took their manufacturers out of Augsburg and Munich once the Allies were able to bomb those cities and set them up in little garages and things all around places like Oberstdorf in the country to escape the bombing. So women who were one day milking cows in a next door valley were the next day making parts for the ME-262 jet engine. So, you know, though Oberstdorf was so remote, it was actually right there in the middle of the war in a curious way. And of course, the other thing is, although they weren't bombed, there were evacuees coming out of the Ruhr and from the beginning of the war to escape the bombing. And then, of course, at the end of the war, there were all the refugees fleeing the Russians from the east. So the population of the village was more than doubled. And refugees, evacuees, all these people had terrible tales to tell. So funnily enough, Oberstdorf, as a prism through which to look at the whole Third Reich period, is extraordinarily effective.
That's incredible. I tell you, Julia, up until now, I was unaware of these sort of subspecies of concentration camps that begin cropping up. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, there was just about 5 miles out of Oberstdorf, there was a Waffen-SS camp training. I mean, the boys, the poor wretched boys, went straight from the Hitler Youth into training. And at the end of the war, they only had about 3 weeks training before they were sent out to the front line. And this Waffen-SS camp was built by prisoners sent directly from Dachau. And I know a lot about it because, and this is an interesting story, it shows what a big part technology plays in this kind of research. Because I did know the name, thanks to my collaborator, Katy, of a Polish forced laborer who ended up in Dachau. And I emailed the Dachau archives at about 8 o'clock one morning. By 20 past eight, I had a reply and a scan of the letter that this prisoner, Bozawa, had written and deposited in the Dachau archives, detailing his entire experience at this camp just outside Oberstdorf. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that without technology, I would never have probably managed to track that letter down. And then there were camps not very far away with barbed wire and dogs and flat. I mean, there was a great assortment of different camps. So, and Auschwitz and Dachau and all the big camps had these little camps. They sent out people to work where they were needed. And there was another Dachau subcamp close to Oberstdorf, which where the conditions were terrible. The mortality rate was, I think, nil, but only for the simple reason when the prisoners got too sick, they were sent back to Dachau, the main camp. And all the food was sent out from Dachau. So it's, you know, it's like a sort of city with these grotesque villages all around them. They were great institutions, these, and not great in that sense. I mean, horrific institutions that spawned all these imitations of themselves across the country.
Wow. No, thank you, Julia. I appreciate that. You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about history being gray. If there's one thing history certainly is not, it's black and white. And I'm curious if there are any particular instances that you can think of either resistance or collaboration with the Nazi regime within that village.
Oh, well, boy, the whole of the end. I mean, there's a really exciting denouement to all this, because right at the end of the war, the village was divided, really, between people who were passionate Nazis. And it wasn't, of course, just the village by this point, because, as I said, there were all these other people that come to the village. And because there was an SS training camp nearby that drew Nazis, as indeed did Zonthofen, so there were lots of dedicated Nazis. But then there were also a lot of villagers who wanted to surrender to the Allies. They realized that, you know, it was hopeless. They didn't want their village to be bombarded to bits. So amazingly, a resistance force was put together. How they managed to keep it secret, I don't know. Well, it's all written up in the book. But there was a really exciting climax at the end. And, you know, it was very hard to know who was going to win and how it was all going to pan out. But the great thing was that the Heimatschutz, as it was called, the resistance group, did manage to surrender Oberstdorf to the French before, despite all the threats about executions and so on. And the Nazis sort of faded away. But it was really quite frightening because the mountains were all around. And of course, a lot of Nazis fled to the mountains and nobody was quite sure whether, you know, the resistance would continue. In the end, Oberstdorf, as I say, was handed over peacefully first to the French and then the Americans took over and the village was saved. But it could have been very different. And in other places, right in the last days of the war, people who tried to surrender were hanged. One pregnant woman was hanged only a few days before the end of the war. So, you know, it varied very much from one small community to the next. But Oberstdorf was lucky. It survived. And then collaboration. Well, collaboration, there were wasn't so much collaboration as because it was, of course, a German village. So collaboration in a way is the wrong word. It was
indifference, perhaps?
Well, not even indifference, just people who were very, very supportive of the regime, of the Nazi regime. So there were diehard Nazis in the village who stayed diehard Nazis right to the bitter end. And there was Hermann Otto Heuer was one of Nazis' favorite artists who lived in the village. And his painting, which I think is in Washington, which was called, in the beginning was the word, shows Hitler depicted as the Messiah, surrounded by devoted disciples. And that became one of the most famous images of the whole of the Third Reich. And that was painted by a man living in Oberstdorf. Now, he stayed a fanatic Nazi, no doubt, to the end. It's not so much collaboration. It's more whether people remained loyal to the Nazis or whether they changed their minds or whether they resisted and joined the Heimatschutz.
Wow. Incredible, Julia. Thank you. Oh, wow. Time flies when you're having fun. I have just a couple questions left, Julia, if that's okay.
Sure, sure.
I'd love to know, in your view, how does the story of the village fit into the larger narrative of Nazi Germany?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I've thought about that quite a lot. I think I would be at pains not to suggest that Oberstdorf is in any sense a typical village. I mean, clearly it isn't, not least because of its geographical position. But I think probably that the sensible answer is that every small town and village forged its own relationship with the regime. But having said that, I think, you know, looking at one village and the way we've looked at Oberstdorf does offer fresh insights. First of all, I think probably in any small community or town that you look at, you would get the same diverse response to the Nazis. You know, there would be those who were absolutely won over, those who were not political, and those who resisted. And to a greater extent, a greater or lesser extent, you'd always get a similar kind of mix like that. But then, of course, individuals in small communities play a great part. And Oberstdorf is exceptional because not only was Mayor Fink a very moderate Nazi, but his superior, who was the Kreisleiter, the next one up, who was a very senior Nazi, he too was a very moderate man. And the story for Oberstdorf could have been very different, perhaps, if both the mayor and the Kreisleiter had been very the sort of nastier kind of Nazi. It's very difficult to, as I say, to generalize, but I think that lessons that we should take away is that people had to survive themselves. It wasn't easy, and people did change their minds, but they were living in a totalitarian state, and their neighbors, many of their neighbors, were very pro-Nazi, so you had to be extremely careful. Though, in fact, very few Oberstdorfers were actually sent to prison. There was always a climate of fear, not so much from families and friends, but the Hitler Youth leaders, and particularly, I think, the sort of low-ranking Nazi officials, people who very often had not been particularly successful as in their jobs before, and then suddenly they were given some authority by the regime and would sort of strut around the place looking to pounce on any villager not conforming. So there was definitely a climate of fear, and the school was an interesting place. The headmaster tried to walk a very difficult, narrow line because, obviously, Nazis had a very firm grip on education. And if he'd been seen not to be towing the party line, there are other teachers or even students who would have informed on him. But so he outwardly seems to have been a straight-up Nazi, but in fact, he managed to introduce into his school a surprisingly humane atmosphere. And after the war, when he was tried, a lot of the students came forward to say that he had actually done his best within very difficult constraints to maintain a sense of humanity in his school.
How interesting. Thank you, Julia. Excellent. So once again, the book is called A Village in the Third Reich, How Ordinary Lives Were Transformed by the Rise of Fascism. I'd love to know, Julia, my last question, as a matter of fact, what are you working on next? Are there any upcoming projects you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'm conforming to my leaping from lily pad to lily pad. Actually, I'm very keen on classical music, and there's a wonderful hall here in London called Wigmore Hall, which is very famous around the world for people who like chamber music. And I was asked to write a history of that. And you may think that's a very dull subject, but surprisingly enough, it isn't. It's full of human stories and so on. And it was originally the Bechstein Hall, built by the German piano manufacturers. And if you Google Edwin Bechstein, up comes a photograph of his funeral in 1934, and Helene Bechstein is sort of on the arm of Hitler. And she, his wife, I mean, Edwin Bechstein's wife, was so keen on Hitler. She was one of the very earliest supporters. And when he was in prison, she used to supply him with the paper that he wrote Mein Kampf. But anyway, in the First World War, the Bechstein Hall, it was taken away from the Bechstein family and it became Wigmore Hall. So I'm having great fun writing that, but that is a rather niche subject. But it's the same ingredients, a human story, human stories and experiences, and written in looking at it in this case through the prism of a chamber music hall, whereas with the Village book, obviously, I was looking at what I suppose you could call, at least it certainly seems that way to me, the most far-reaching tragedy in human history. And this was looking at that through one small village.
It's incredible. Julia Boyd, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. I really appreciated it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, likewise, Julia. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.